Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Hello and welcome to Stick Together, Australia's only national radio show all about workers' rights and social justice. Stick Together is produced at 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne and broadcast right around the country on the Community Radio Network. I'm Diana Beaumont. The ascendance of Islamic State in Iraq and Syria has reignited debate about how Australia deals with the threat of domestic terrorism. On the 18th of September, 800 police raided more than 27 Muslim homes in Sydney and Brisbane, detaining 15 people and charging two. The raids have been criticised as a theatrical political stunt. Critics argue that there was no need for 800 police with helicopters to carry out such dramatic dawn raids. The evidence on which charges were laid was very dubious. An alleged phone call where the suspect received orders to carry out an ill-defined and random attack on a member of the Australian public. And the timing of the raids was also very telling. The raids came shortly after the announcement that Australia will send its army back to Iraq and arm gangs in Syria to fight the Assad government. The massive police operation also took place 1 week before the government planned to bring new anti-terror laws to a vote in the parliament. To analyse these latest anti-terror raids and the legislative changes that the government's proposing, we're joined today by an expert with extensive experience in defending Australians from domestic terror laws. I have on the phone criminal defence lawyer Rob Starry, who's kind enough to speak to me during his interstate holiday. Rob, thanks for joining us on Stick Together.
My pleasure, and I'm happy to contribute.
Rob, tell us a bit about the work that you do so our listeners have a sense of just how intimately acquainted you are with Australia's domestic terror legislation.
Well, I've been practising as a criminal defence lawyer for over 30 years, and in particular since 2002, when the first suite of anti-terror laws were introduced. I've been involved in the prosecution as a defence lawyer for each person that's been charged with any terrorism offence in the state of Victoria. So that includes offences under the Foreign Incursions Act in Syria, recruitment of people in Melbourne and Sydney. Those cases haven't been determined yet, but there are charges on foot.
And before we analyse terror laws more generally and their political context, share with us your reaction to these latest police raids in Sydney and Brisbane.
Well, I'm guarded about what's suggested from the AFP in terms of the purpose of the raids. I'm guarded about, as you say, the proposed legislation amendments that are before the Parliament this week. And of course, these cases invariably have a political context. We've seen, of course, government commitment to intervention into northern Iraq. And I don't think we can divorce this. We've seen the incursion into the Gaza Strip come completely off the front page. And, of course, the budget's gone completely. Any discussion about the draconian nature of the budget is just finished.
Well, after the raids last Thursday, the 18th of September, one man, Omarjan Azari, appeared briefly in a Sydney court. What's he been charged with and what will happen to him now?
Well, I don't know the precise form of the charges other than I think there's a charge called a conspiracy to commit an act in preparation of a terrorist act. Now, that sounds remote and that sounds a bit nebulous, but I think that goes to the suggestion that he was proposing to execute innocent civilians as a result of the direction that he received from someone in northern Iraq. I'll say the second person hasn't been charged with terrorism offences, but rather possession of ammunition. And so there's nothing, as I understand it, from the charges that suggests that possession of that ammunition is related to the commission of a terrorist offence. Otherwise, he would have been charged with the conspiracy. conspiracy offence or something else, committing acts in preparation of a terrorist act. I mean, we've seen that in other cases in which there's initially been arrest, press conferences, press releases where the cases have been overstated and embellished, and the ultimate evidence doesn't bear any semblance to what's suggested at the point of the initial arrest. But the fact of the matter is that we are about to embark on another military intervention in Iraq, and I expect the government and its agencies want to send a message to the Islamic community that if you support philosophically, ideologically, financially, any of those organisations in the Middle East, then we'll come down on you hard.
Another dimension of the government's anti-terror campaign is the cancelling of passports of people suspected of aiding jihadis overseas, or even the family members of these suspects. What are the human rights or civil rights implications of this?
Well, this has been going on for actually some years now, that there are people have been prohibited from travelling, particularly to Afghanistan and other parts of the Middle East and the subcontinent, Pakistan, and then into the Arabian Peninsula. So that's been going on for some time. Now, those persons aren't necessarily convicted of any offence. They receive a security classification from ASIO. It's a bit like with refugee, in the refugee example. There might be adverse assessments and their passports are removed. They're very draconian powers, and they prevent a person's right to travel and to visit family or to do other things.
We're speaking to criminal defence lawyer Rob Starry. The revamp of Australia's anti-terror laws began after 9/11 in 2001. Rob, tell us, what new powers did the Howard government give the security services?
If you speak to Brett Walker, who was the independent monitor on national security legislation, he describes the powers as being so dense and so widespread that even he, as the most qualified person in the country, can't understand the need for further laws. He talks about 46 separate pieces of legislation. So you have association offences, you have financing offences, you have rather nebulous offences, a conspiracy to commit an act in preparation of a terrorist act. So there's a vast array of offences.
And the police got new powers under the Howard era, legislative changes including ability to hold people for 14 days without charge, conduct warrantless searches of private property.
Yeah, that's the preventative detention orders. And the government had determined that that should be permanently on the statute books. Today have they said that as a result of further consultation, particularly with the Islamic community, that there will be an extension of those orders for another 10 years. Now, last week, a number of people were placed in preventative detention in Sydney, and they were then released and released without charge.
And what further powers does the Abbott government and the security forces want to fight the threat of domestic terrorism?
They're talking about an offence of advocating terrorist activity. And I think that's crudely described as been identified as radical sheikhs or imams that talk about violent jihad. So that's the advocacy provision. So that's one lot. The other is, of course, is to go into a designated foreign hotspot, and that the designated area will be determined by the Foreign Affairs Minister. And that's a curious provision because Senator Brandis, for instance, talked about at one point people being prohibited from going to various cities or towns. How they would ever enforce that, how they would ever identify a particular city or town, but would it include, for instance, Nigeria? Would it include Sudan? Yemen? Would it include Israel? What are the other hotspots and how can it possibly be enforced? Now, what's more draconian about that law is that the onus of proof, despite what Senator Brandis says, the onus of proof would be on the accused to show that they're there for a lawful purpose. So it's a very draconian piece of legislation, and I'm extremely troubled by it.
You're listening to Stick Together, all about workers' rights and social justice.
Every week on the Community Radio Network.
We're speaking to criminal defence lawyer Rob Starry. Rob, can I just ask you to speak as clearly as you can, because the quality on the phone isn't the best.
I'm sorry about that.
That's okay. How have these terror laws been used to date? And let's start with the case of the so-called Barwon 13, who you represented after they were arrested in 2005. They were connected to another 9 men charged in Sydney, who you didn't represent. But tell us about this case.
Well, in November 2005, coincidentally, in the week that the work choices legislation was being debated in the Senate, and dramatically, people in Melbourne and Sydney were arrested. They were charged with being members of their own unnamed and unspecified homegrown jihadist organisation. They were separately charged with other offences, including being in possession of a homemade jihadist DVD or video. They were, of course, all remanded in custody. But at the time of their arrest, both politicians in New South Wales, there were joint press conferences between the premiers of New South Wales and Victoria and the chief commissioners of each state, saying that iconic landmarks had been identified and an imminent terrorist attack had been thwarted. The fact of the matter, though, was that there was no evidence to support that. There was no imminent terrorist attack thwarted. There was certainly bravado and talk amongst the men about repercussions for our involvement in Afghanistan and Iraq. It was the Old Testament notion, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. As if innocent civilians had been killed in Iraq, therefore the same reprisal should take place in Australia. But nothing, it was talk, and nothing had actually eventuated. And ultimately, in Melbourne, at least four of those people were completely acquitted of all charges of the 13, and another four were acquitted as the second offence of possession of the thing, and eight of them were convicted of being members of the homegrown jihadist organisation. But the lesson learned out of that litigation was that the evidence, the dramatic evidence that was released at the point of their arrest, did not match the evidence that was, the admissible evidence that was produced at trial.
And the 13 men held at Barwon Prison were held in solitary confinement, were they not?
Correct. Yep. They were manacled when they were out of their cells, shackled, but with both leg irons and shackled. And they were both placed in very austere circumstances, akin to really Guantanamo Bay-type circumstances, wearing the orange jumpsuits. The court said this is intolerable. These men are unconvicted. They can't instruct their lawyers properly. They can't engage in the trial process. And so they were moved from the maximum security prison at Barwon. It was like the Goulburn Supermax prison in New South Wales. They were moved to the Metropolitan Prison, where there would at least be easier access.
Rob Starry, you also represented two Tamils charged with sending money to the Tamil Tigers in Sri Lanka. Tell us about their case.
Yes, well, in fact, three people charged, one from Sydney and two from Melbourne. We represented all of them, and they were charged with being members of the Tamil Tigers, and you can be a member of a terrorist organisation officially or unofficially, and they were charged with funding that organisation. And there are a whole range of other subsidiary offences as well. And what happened in their case was that they were raising money for humanitarian relief in the north and east of Sri Lanka.
After the tsunami.
After the tsunami. And it was said at the time of their arrest it was said by an assistant commissioner of police in Melbourne that money that had been raised by the Australian community for the Tamil community who were the subject of the tsunami, that money had been diverted for military purposes. And in fact, there was no evidence either in the trial, there was no statement, there was no financial document supporting that assertion. Fact of the matter is that after 3 years of litigation, the charges were withdrawn because of the time of the offending. Firstly, the Tamil Tigers were not a proscribed organisation in Australia, and even in Sri Lanka, they had been deproscribed during the peace process. And the fact of the matter is that it could not be said that these men were involved in any act of terrorism, either in Australia or within Sri Lanka. And they had, of course, spent some time in remand before they were released on bail. Now, that's another graphic example of a highly political case, because it's now revealed that the prosecution was initiated at the behest of the Rajapaksa regime, and that the Australian government, in a complicit way, had been party to what was said to be the defunding of the Tamil Tigers through the diaspora around the world. And even if it was only funding for humanitarian purposes, as it was in this case, it was important to break the back of the Tamil Tigers.
It's well documented in the US that the FBI has been involved in entrapment, meaning FBI spies invent fake terrorist plots, go out recruiting people to take part in them, and then they charge the people that they've duped with terrorism offences. And if listeners want to know more about these cases, they can find a link to a Human Rights Watch report on the Stick Together Facebook page. Rob Starry, is there evidence that ASIO or the Australian Federal Police engage in entrapment?
Oh, yeah. It's in fact a very common policing technique, and they're involved in certainly infiltration of all of these groups. They were involved in the infiltration of the Barwon 13, where they had someone, a federal police officer, used or infiltrated the group to say, well, I can show you how to detonate a bomb. And it's almost farcical now to reflect on it, but when he'd taken the head of the group, a person called Nasser Ben Brika, into a place ironically known as Mount Disappointment, to show him how to detonate a bomb, there's the vision, but there's also the audio saying, it was Nasser Ben Brika saying, look, if you want to show me this thing, you better hurry up because I've got to pick my kids up at school at 3 o'clock. And so he was certainly involved in encouragement and the fostering of terrorism and by his involvement. It was true, it's been true in all other cases. In the Holsworthy Army Barracks case, there are people who are involved as adjunct provocateurs. It's also true in a lot of the radical student cases, environmental cases, and certainly within Australia and outside of Australia. Infiltration and entrapment is a big part of policing technique in the modern era.
And it's important to view the threat of domestic terrorism in that light, that actually a lot of the charges originate from terror plots that were never going to happen in the first place and were initiated by the security forces. And they find people who are interested in those radical ideas, but there's no evidence that those people had any intent to commit the acts on their own.
And their justification is that these people, as you say, are radicalised, they have a susceptibility to this sort of behaviour, and all they're doing is enhancing that susceptibility, showing that they're a risk to the community. Mm-hmm. But whether that's a proper policing technique or not, and whether that's politically appropriate or not, really is for others to judge, but it is a very common practice.
Stick together.
Yeah.
Stick together.
You're listening to Stick Together on Community Radio.
Come along to 3CR's fundraiser of the new documentary Radical Wollongong.
Wollongong developed around the most exploited labour condition.
The percentage of unemployed women was higher.
Women were trying to get jobs in steelworks.
I'm totally against coal seam mining because of the destruction it will do the country.
Friday, 26th of September at 6:30pm at Trades Hall, Lygon Street.
Tore up the paper and I got involved in the anti-conscription movement.
Communist leaders of trade unions delivered the industrial goods.
Tickets are $8 concession or $15 full. So come along and see this first Melbourne screening of Radical Wollongong. We're speaking to criminal defence lawyer Rob Starry. And at this point, I wanted to reflect on a poem written by the German pastor Martin Niemöller that people have been citing a lot on social media in response to these latest anti-terror raids. And it goes, "First they came for the socialists and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a Jew. And then they came for me and there was no one left to speak for me." And this poem's a reminder that if we accept draconian laws to fight terror, this sets a precedent for other rights to be removed. And the campaign against anti-terror laws, there's only one civil rights struggle going on in Australia at the moment. In February this year, the Victorian government passed legislation that gives police the powers to fine protesters if they refuse to move on from a rally or demonstration, and the police can exclude them from returning to that area. And if the protester returns to an excluded area, they face a jail term of 2 years. This has already passed in Victoria. Now, similarly in Tasmania, laws have passed the lower house that, if passed by the upper house, will set $10,000 fines for protests that disrupt workplaces and 3 month jail sentences for repeat offences. These are not one and the same as the terror laws, but they are on the same spectrum. Would you agree, Rob Starry?
Well, absolutely. And we've seen an adaptation of the terrorism laws both industrially and politically. And it's dangerous because if we have laws that are designed to suppress dissent, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, ostensibly and initially for terrorism purposes, but then adapted for political purposes, we're heading down a slippery slope. And we've seen that in the Occupy movements. We've acted for many of those people. We saw it in an attack on principally students in the Max Brenner cases, though that's the Israeli chocolate company that was supplying services to the Israeli Defence Forces, where people were involved in peaceful protests in Melbourne and elsewhere, in which it was said that they had beset premises and prevented trade going on, and they were charged with a range of offences. Now, fortunately, Melbourne were able to invoke the Charter of Rights and Responsibilities that specifically talks about freedom of assembly and freedom of speech. But that case took a month to resolve favourably for the protesters. But there are other states that don't have Charter of Rights and Responsibilities Acts or Bill of Rights. But the danger is that these laws will be adapted. Exclusion zones, we've seen that in G20 protests. Establishment of exclusion zones, the removal of a presumption of bail, and the right to arrest people without warrants, to move them on, and we even saw an adaptation of that when there was the World Youth Day conducted in Sydney. One would think there would be no difficulty there, but in what was a religious program largely, and even if there were protests there, invoke anti-terrorism laws there just seem to me to be extraordinary.
And to build public support for legislation that lessens the rights for certain sections of the population requires demonisation of that group through the media and through government rhetoric. We can clearly see that going on with Muslims right now, but also with trade unionists. The Royal Commission into Union Corruption is digging up unsubstantiated, dirty smears against leading union figures. And similarly, the Howard government used the Coal Commission to demonise building workers and make way for the Australian Building and Construction Commission that stripped building workers of their civil rights, such as the right to silence when called in for questioning by the ABCC. Rob Starry, what do you think this smear campaign around the Royal Commission into Union Corruption is leading to?
Well, I share your sentiment that really it will firstly be the construction industry that's targeted, and we've seen that, as you say, with the Australian Building Construction Commission. You have no right of silence, no right to silence, no right against self-incrimination. If you don't answer questions, you're liable to end up in prison in 6 months. The legislation in the ABCC mirrors the anti-terrorism legislation. We've seen that further adapted in the Fair Work Commission and the Australian Consumer and Competition Commission. And when it looks at secondary boycotts in the construction industry against Grocon or Boral or any of the other companies. And so those same laws are adopted in each of those tribunals. And they will be further enhanced and developed. And as you say, there's a demonisation, particularly of the leadership, but generally of the people who work in the construction industry. And it'll be the construction industry first. It'll be other blue collar unions. It'll be the waterside workers or the MUA. And I suspect it'll be the electrical trades union or other militant blue collar unions, particularly, or even teachers, dare I say, who will be the subject of these sorts of draconian pieces of legislation. Now, unless we resist it, as you rightly say, both political protest and industrial protest, then workers' rights and our democratic rights will be severely eroded. It's often said that we'll be no better than the various countries that have dictatorships and totalitarian regimes. And although we have a democratic regime in place at the moment, every erosion of these rights diminishes those democratic values.
We need to balance civil rights with the prevention of crime and harm to the public. My last question, Rob, is how can we correct this balance in Australia?
Well, I think we need to have transparency and we have to have accountability of agencies. We can't have an agency like the Australian Federal Police or ASIO to have carte blanche to do whatever they want, and where they have a government that shows no resistance. I think they've recently said we'll adopt every recommendation that the intelligence agencies and the community agencies ask for. We need to have an independent monitor of national security legislation, but we need to have open public debate. And we ought not rush legislation through. If there's a demonstrated need to protect innocent civilians or to protect the community, then so be it. But we ought to have lengthy public debate. These things go on the statute books forever, and they're very rarely repealed.
Well, Rob Starry, criminal defence lawyer, thank you so much for joining us today on Stick Together and sharing with us your experience in defending people who've come on the wrong side of this anti-terror legislation.
My pleasure.
And remember, you can share this episode of Stick Together with friends or catch up on past episodes by subscribing to our podcast via iTunes or 3CR's website, www.3cr.org.au. You can also get in touch with us by emailing sticktogether3cr@gmail.com or calling 3CR Radio on 03 9419 8377. And that's all we have time for on Stick Together this week. I'm Diana Beaumont. Thanks for listening, and do tune in again at the same time next week.